I'm Tenery Taylor. The Great Kosher Meat War of 1902. Never heard of it? Thousands of poor housewives end up in the streets of New York. They smash delis, throw their neighbors' meat into the gutters, end up in jail or in the hospital. They're up against big corporate players and greedy middlemen, but no one should underestimate them. This is a story that harkens back to the Boston Tea Party and will come to influence activism throughout the 20th century. Here to tell it is historian Scott Seligman, author of The Great Kosher Meat War of 1902, Immigrant Housewives and the Riots That Shook New York City. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you, Tenery. It's nice to be here.
Now, would you just kind of introduce us to the Jewish community in New York City at this time?
Sure. The Jewish community that we're talking about were primarily Russian and Eastern European immigrants who started to arrive in large numbers in America in about 1880. And by 1902, there were probably something like 600,000 of them. And they were, for the most part, clustered in the lower Manhattan, in the neighborhood that's referred to as the Lower East Side. And these were people who lived their religion 24/7. They didn't leave Russia and Eastern Europe in order to change their lives, particularly in America. They wanted just to be allowed to practice their religion the way they had in the old country. And one of the requirements of if you're an Orthodox Jew is that you must eat kosher food. And kosher food is defined fairly clearly in the Hebrew Bible and as well as the Talmud as far as what kinds of foods are can and cannot be kosher, if it's a question of meat, how it must be slaughtered and by whom, and how it must be prepared. These people basically could not eat meat that was not kosher. It would have been against their religion.
Now, they're living in a big city. How are they getting this meat and making sure that it's kosher?
Well, for that, you need to start the other part of the story. The early 20th century is the era of the trusts. You've heard of the Standard Oil Trust, the Steel Trust, the Railroad Trust. Well, there was such a thing as a meat trust or a beef trust, and it was based in Chicago. And the economics of it were such that these were companies that bought cattle that had been raised in the West and brought to the Midwest to be fattened up, slaughtered in Chicago, and then sent to the larger cities in the East Coast as carcasses. These are people with names like Swift and Armour that we still know today from brand names. Mm-hmm. And there were about a half a dozen of them that were considered to be the beef trust, and they were essentially a cartel. They were attempting to corner the national market on meat so that they could raise and lower prices at will. In the 1870s, with the invention of the refrigerator car, all of a sudden you could bring produce and meat across country with very little spoilage. And the economics were such that most of New York got its meat that, had been slaughtered in Chicago and sent as carcasses. The problem for the Jewish community was that they couldn't get their meat this way. One of the requirements of kosher meat is that it must be salted and drained of its blood and soaked in order to drain it of blood within 72 hours of slaughter. And this is because it's forbidden to eat the lifeblood of the animal, and blood coagulates after 72 hours.
Okay.
So for the Jewish community, the meat had to come in on the hoof, which is far more expensive because you can fit fewer animals in. There was a lot of parts that aren't used. So they were already paying more for meat even before the religious authorities supervise its slaughter and its distribution. So the Jewish community was paying far more for its meat than everybody else was. And when this cartel in Chicago began to raise prices in early 1902, they raised them very quickly. The reality was that a pound of meat, a pound of kosher meat, formerly on sale for 12 cents a pound, now cost 18 cents a pound. That doesn't sound like much today, but that's it's more or less something like $5.50 today for a pound.
Mm-hmm.
And for families that were making $2 a day, maybe $10, $12 a week, that's all the breadwinners were taking home. This was a major, major increase. And what happened was kosher meat became unaffordable to a lot of the families on the Lower East Side.
Well, so you've mentioned a couple layers here in the production. You've got the meat packers in Chicago who are shipping the meat to slaughterhouses, kosher slaughterhouses. I assume they're in New York City or close by.
Mm-hmm.
And so who's raising the prices, the slaughterhouses or well, the beef producers?
Yeah, you're getting right to the nub of the problem. The prices were being set by the primarily by the cartel in Chicago. They decided how much meat they were going to send east and how much they were going to charge for it. And they were, of course, gouging everybody. They were gouging the railroads for kickbacks and things as well. The meat would come in. The cows would come in. They'd, most of them would stay on the New Jersey side of the Hudson River for a day or two to after the journey. Then they would be brought by barge to the slaughterhouses in Manhattan, which were located on the rivers. There was one on the Hudson, and there were two major ones on the East River that did kosher slaughter. They would then be slaughtered and distributed to the individual retail butchers, of which there were some 600 on the Lower East Side of New York in this time.
And these are kosher butchers?
Kosher, ostensibly kosher butchers. Oh. There were some of them who were probably paying fast and loose with the rules, but yes, these were the kosher butchers, and they were the front of the end of the line as far as the women who bought the meat were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And it was primarily the women who were at home and who were in charge of the household. So that's why this became a women's movement.
Let's talk about these women. What was their role in the society and in the home?
Well, the women who actually were involved in this were middle-aged. Well, age maybe 30-something and above. They were primarily not working outside of the home. Their daughters had begun to do that. They would work in some of the sweatshops and things in the garment trade. But the women, most of these women were not employed outside of the home. Their husbands were the breadwinners. And they were in charge of keeping the house. And the husbands would typically bring all of the money home, give it to their wives, and the wives decided how it was going to be spent. So they were the ones who first felt the problem when meat became more dear. Mm. These were very observant women. They lived in tenements in the Lower East Side, basically very small apartments that probably weren't intended for the number of people who lived there. And they had relationships with their butchers that were based on trust. They had to trust that the butchers were, in fact, giving them pure meat that was certifiably kosher. And the butchers often had to extend them credit. They would buy meat, and then they would pay them at the end of the week. So it was actually a close relationship before it fell apart. And what happened was, once the price started to go up, the wholesale price started to go up, the first people who realized it was going to be a problem were the butchers themselves. They knew their clients, these women, would not be able to absorb a 50% increase.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was they closed their doors for a few days. They got together. They decided that they were going to pressure their suppliers by not buying for several days. They closed the doors. And the women of the Lower East Side supported them in this because everybody was on the same side. And they managed to get some paltry concessions out of the wholesalers, but they were nothing near what was needed. And when they reopened, they made the mistake of actually raising the price of meat rather than lowering it. And that's what set this off. The women felt that they had been betrayed by their butchers.
Were they forced to raise the price because the wholesalers just wouldn't cave?
That's right. At least the price of a pound of beef was not one of the concessions that they made. So they had no choice. They couldn't make any money on the meat unless they raised the price.
Mm.
And they knew that the women weren't going to be able to afford it, which is in fact the case.
Yeah.
But the women, one of the characteristics of this whole thing was that nobody could really see any further back in the supply chain than the immediate predecessor. So the women blamed their butchers, who may have been marginally responsible, but they weren't setting the prices. They had to set prices based on what they paid. The butchers blamed the wholesalers. The wholesalers blamed the trust back in Chicago. And when the Chicago cartel was queried about it, they blamed the cattlemen. They said there aren't enough cows, and that's why the price went up.
Mm.
But what was really going on here was that there was a cabal of companies in Chicago that were trying to raise prices and raise profits, and they really didn't care who got hurt.
Well, I want to meet some of these women who began agitating in the street. I wonder, could you introduce us to Sarah Edelson?
I sure can. She's my favorite. One of the problems in doing the research was Well, actually, one of the joys of doing the research was that I was able to do genealogical research on some of these women, and I found descendants of them. And I got some family stories from them as well, which was great. But the heartbreak was that there are no photographs of these women. And that was a problem. But we can paint a pretty good verbal portrait of them from the press. And I looked at both the English language press and also the Yiddish language press, which was very revealing, because Yiddish papers survive for both the Orthodox perspective and also the socialist perspective for this particular period. But Sarah Edelson is the one who started the whole thing. She got disgusted when the price of meat went up, and she called a meeting on May 14, 1902 at Monroe Palace, which was the name of the saloon that her family operated. It was on Monroe Street. That's where the name came from. She expected about 50 people, but 500 women showed up and spilled out onto Monroe Street. Mm-hmm. Sarah was a force of nature. She was a large woman, physically very imposing. By several accounts, she weighed about 250 pounds. She had a booming voice that rang with authority, and Sarah was a natural leader, she was a born organizer. She had arrived in the United States in 1868, which was actually quite early for Russian Jews. Most of the immigration didn't begin until the 1880s. She was a mother of six, but motherhood had never kept her homebound. She also, in addition to helping manage the saloon, she earned extra money as a matchmaker, trying to pull lonely hearts together. She never shrank from a fight. She was about 50 years old at the time of the strike. And then you should also meet Carolyn Schatzberg, who was a Romanian Jew. She emigrated about 1885, and at the time of the strike, she was 51. She was a widow. She had just lost her husband a few months earlier. She had two of her seven children still at home, and she was a woman of some means. She actually had a servant in the home, but she was very happy to fight for those who were less fortunate than she was. And in her 18 years in America, she had mastered English. She was almost eloquent in the language, actually. And she actually took over leadership of the movement, but not without a struggle with Sarah Edelson.
Well, was there bad blood?
Bad blood, yes. The problem was that once they got around to forming an organization, it was called the Ladies Anti-Beef Trust Association. Sarah, who had basically founded the whole movement, decided that she ought to be president of it, but she wasn't elected. Carolyn was elected. And there was one scene, one of the more picturesque scenes in the book, where Carolyn is trying to chair a meeting, and Sarah and several of her friends basically storm in and push them off stage in an effort to take over the meeting. But actually, that doesn't really tell the story of the organization, because as a practical matter, this was a fairly well-disciplined movement. And the reason I say that is when the women got out onto the streets and started I haven't really told you about that yet, what really happened after this meeting. Maybe I'll start there.
Because she gets out there. She thinks she's going to get about, 50 people. She gets 500 people. And then what happens?
Okay, so what happened was, it's my favorite quote in the whole book. A woman named Fanny Levy stood up at this meeting. And she said in good Yiddish, she said, she was talking about the butcher's strike and how ineffective it had been. And she said, "This is their strike?" And then she said, "Let the women make a strike, then there will be a strike." In fact, that's what I originally wanted to call the book, Let the Women Make a Strike. Right now it's just a chapter title. And that's what they decided to do. They used the term strike. They borrowed a lot of terminology from the labor movements, but of course it wasn't a strike. It was a boycott. And what they decided to do is overnight they recruited women, and by the wee hours of the following morning, they had almost no time to do this, there were women assembled in squads of five on every street in the Lower East Side where butcher shops were located. And their instructions were to remonstrate with anyone who wanted to be a customer, anybody who wanted to buy meat, argue with them, tell them why it was important that they do without meat for a period of time so that the prices would come down. And it was supposed to be nonviolent. Unfortunately, it didn't stay that way. Women who crossed their lines and went in and bought meat anyway risked getting the meat seized from them when they emerged, thrown into the gutter, and generally kerosene was poured on it so that it couldn't be consumed.
Mm.
And then when the butchers, a lot of the butchers realized what was going on, they closed, but most of them didn't. And the women then pressured the butchers to close down because that was the only way they really saw that the prices would become affordable again, because if nobody bought any meat.
I want to talk a little bit about this practice. You called it a strike, and then you said, well, it was a boycott. But, I mean, those are kind of two different things. Usually we think of a boycott, you stop buying something. But a strike, you're out there, you're getting between yourself and the public, or between, excuse me, between the public and the merchant, and really making a public scene.
There certainly was that. In this case, because it was only available retail, you know, you had to actually be at the store to buy it. They tried to get in between the women and the butchers. But the terminology, they called people who crossed their lines to go in, they called them scabs. You know, these were terminology they really borrowed from the labor movement, from the unionization movement that was going on.
Right. Was this typically applied to retail situations, this kind of strike?
Well, there wasn't really anything typical about this. This was the vanguard. This just hadn't happened before. And that was why it was so exciting to write about it, because this was something new. Women didn't take to the streets in New York in 1902. A little bit later on they did, when they were pushing for suffrage and things, but not in 1902. And, of course, they got beaten up for the process. In the process, the police came, and they used their billy clubs, and a lot of women went to jail, and a lot of women went to the hospital.
And had they prepared for this? I mean, you said there was kerosene on hand, so they must have kind of had a bit of a battle plan.
Well, kerosene was very freely available for two reasons. One is that for lighting lamps, and people cooked on kerosene stoves.
Okay.
But also it was used to kill bed bugs. And so it was pretty much available on the Lower East Side. It wasn't hard to get it. Now, whether they showed up with it or not, I can't tell you. I don't really know that. But yeah, this was supposed to be nonviolent, and it wasn't. And that's the only area in which I think they were not, they weren't strategic. Otherwise, they had their eyes squarely on their goal. They didn't destroy, when they destroyed butcher shops, which they did to a certain extent when the butchers wouldn't close, they didn't destroy the shops next door. They didn't, their targets were the butcher shops. When they destroyed meat and poured kerosene on it, nobody took the meat home and tried to cook it. It was, they realized that they had to work together and that nobody should eat meat for a period of time. The other area where discipline was very clear was about the third day, I think it was, of the strike. It was Friday, and Friday night is when the Jewish Sabbath begins.
Mm-hmm.
Friday night to Saturday night, and all the demonstrations stopped, and they didn't continue until Saturday night after the Sabbath was over. But the women who used the time actually very productively, they decided to divide up into groups of two and visit all the synagogues on the Lower East Side as a means of reaching the men folk, because the men were mostly at work during the day when all of this was going on. And they wanted to appeal as broadly as they could for support for the boycott, including one of the women who was quite well schooled in the Hebrew Bible. She quoted a line from Genesis in which Adam is told that he has domain over his wife. And one of these women went up and said, please use your authority over your wife to make sure that she doesn't buy any meat in the short term.
Hmm. And were they successful in getting wider public opinion? And I'll ask you about the men. Did they come on board? But what about the larger community? What is everybody else in New York thinking about this?
Well, you look at the press. The socialist Yiddish press was right there with them. You know, anything that opposed big capitalism was fine with them. The New York World was sympathetic to them. People got a little less sympathetic as the longer the strike went on. But the New York World basically said that they're one of the ones that compared it to the Boston Tea Party. They said that, you know, that these women had a legitimate gripe. The newspaper that was most critical of them was the New York Times. It will not do to have women like this running around and, you know, setting fire to meat just because they don't like the people who are selling, you know, something along those lines. But if you look between the lines there, The New York Times was German Jewish run at this point, the Sulzberger family. And there was no love lost between the German Jews and the newly arrived Eastern Europeans and Russians. The German Jews had come earlier. Basically, they started coming about mid-19th century. And although they had started out on the Lower East Side themselves, most of them by this time were living, had made some money. They were more comfortable. They had achieved a certain amount of acceptance in New York society. And they were actually quite threatened by the Eastern Europeans, who did not seem to them to be assimilable. On the other hand, the Eastern Europeans looked at these German Jews, many of whom were Reform Jews. And if you walked into a sanctuary of one of the Reform Jews in Midtown Manhattan, and you saw men and women sitting side by side, the men without their heads covered, or if you saw an organ for organ music, it looked to these Russians for all the world like a Christian church.
Mm.
That simply didn't look like an Orthodox Jewish synagogue, because it wasn't. And so the feeling was kind of mutual. I think they both looked down on each other.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Scott Seligman. He's the author of The Great Kosher Meat War of 1902, Immigrant Housewives and the Riots That Shook New York City. So how long did the strike go on?
It went on for about 3 weeks, but it metastasized. It started out on the Lower East Side. It moved. And they deliberately had relations with Jewish communities outside of Manhattan. It spread to the Bronx. It spread to Brooklyn. It spread across the river to Newark in New Jersey. It even spread as far as Boston. Because after all, I mean, it was kosher meat was kosher meat. Everybody was paying those prices, and everybody couldn't afford it. So it lasted about 3 weeks, and it kind of ended with a whimper rather than a bang. The women had to, in order to build support, the women had to reach out to community organizations. Whether they were social welfare organizations or mutual aid societies, synagogues, other congregations, labor unions, all of this stuff. And in the process of doing that, it was probably inevitable that men would take over a certain amount of the leadership of their movement, because most of these community organizations were managed by men. Women really were mostly in the home in 1902.
Mm-hmm.
Well-respected men joined their movement and were able to negotiate with the police and with the slaughterhouses and stuff in ways that the women probably couldn't have done. So they set up a coalition organization that did not have the word ladies in it like the first organization had. And they basically worked on behalf of the Jewish community to try to get some kind of solution to the problem.
And I just have to ask, did Sarah Edelson and is it Caroline Schatzberg, did they patch up their differences and keep working together throughout this?
Well, they probably, yes, they did, because there are some records of meetings where that both of them attended. But Caroline Schatzberg, interestingly enough that you brought it up, once the butchers reopened, they were trying to get the butchers to agree to keep prices down in perpetuity. And several butchers reopened without such an agreement. And it was ultimately silly, because if the wholesale price went up, they couldn't continue to sell in perpetuity at those prices, because they would have gone out of business.
Sure.
But Caroline Schatzberg felt that the strike had been betrayed after the reopening started. And she went to the Forward, which was the socialist paper, and pleaded for people to continue to strike. But it was too late. And the wind was kind of out of everybody's sails. She didn't specifically blame men, but she did feel that the movement had been betrayed.
Well, when the butchers reopen, at what prices are they offering the meat at this point?
Well, what happened was the butchers were able to offer it back at the original prices, and the reason for that was the negotiations with the slaughterhouses. The slaughterhouses and further back in the chain, the cartel, the whole purpose of raising the prices in the first place was to increase profits, and they weren't making any money. 3 weeks of butcher shops being closed down and destroyed to a certain extent, they weren't selling meat, and so they clearly hadn't raised their profits. So they backed down. But there's another reason that they backed down, because at precisely the time that this was going on, the administration of Theodore Roosevelt stepped in and started to and accused them, in fact took them to court for violations of the Sherman Antitrust Act. They were acting as a trust. And although they denied culpability, it was absolutely apparent to everyone that they were, in fact, operating as a cartel. And the case went to the Supreme Court, not in this period. It took a few more years to get there. And eventually the cartel was, in fact, dismantled. But the Roosevelt administration got an injunction against them, and some of the coordination that they had been doing became they weren't allowed to do. And so that was going on at the same time. And whether it was because the women's strike or because the government had taken away some of their tools to coordinate, you can argue. But both of the things were happening at the same time, and that's really what brought the thing to an end.
What was the impact of this strike on activism in the 20th century going forward?
Well, that's a little bit hard to chart, but not impossible. We know that the 1902 meat strike, first of all, meat went up in price again several times between 1902 and the Depression. And each time there was a kerfuffle on the street, but never anything of the magnitude of the 1902 strike. But there were also things like tenant strikes that happened in New York. And sometimes when these happened, the 1902 strike was specifically cited as a precedent. And not only were they cited as a precedent, but the tactics were the same. And in the case of the first tenant strike, it was also female-oriented, female-organized, not the same women. The women of the 1902 strike were obscure at the beginning, and they sank right back into obscurity afterward and were never heard from again. But a new crop of women emerged during the tenant strikes when rents were going up too high, and used basically the same tactics that the women had used in 1902, leafleting, signage, canvassing in the tenements. The reason that this was new was that New York had certainly seen unionizing movements before, and that some of these tools were used then. But this was community organizing. This wasn't labor organizing, and it was different. There were many, many more people. You know, if you were organizing a union, you knew where everybody worked. You knew how to reach the workers. You knew how to call a meeting and get people there. This was hundreds of thousands of people who had to be organized and had to have explained to them why they had to do something that appeared to them to be against their interest. And that was what made this special.
We've been visiting with Scott Seligman. He's the author of The Great Kosher Meat War of 1902, Immigrant Housewives and the Riots That Shook New York City. Thank you so much for sharing the story with us today.
It's my pleasure.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenere Taylor. When Constant Wonder returns from a short break, we'll have another food fight. The mafia once tried to get in on bagel profits, but the union wouldn't cave. That's next on Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenere Taylor in for Marcus Smith. From wars over the kosher meat market to a mafia battle to gain control of the bagel market. When you live in New York City, anything can happen. In the 60s, bagels were just getting popular there, and the mafia wanted in on the profits. Bagel Union 338, though, would have none of it. To learn more, Marcus Smith sat down a while ago with Jason Turbo, the author of How New York's Bagel Union Fought and Beat a Mafia Takeover.
The main player in my story is a man named Johnny Dio. Johnny Dio Guardi. He was a mafia guy. He was a labor racketeer. His specialty was forming paper locals, union local chapters that had nothing to speak of in the way of membership, but had full voting rights. And he leveraged those rights into getting his pal Jimmy Hoffa elected to the national presidency of the International Teamsters Union. He was a powerful guy with powerful connections. And he had already made significant incursions into two very Jewish sectors in New York City, the garment industry and the kosher foods industry, especially with the latter. He had gone whole hog into taking over as much as he could. There had been a couple of kosher kosher goods companies. One was called Kosher Provisions. The other was called American Kosher Provisions. American had actually mobbed up. I mean, it's kind of a convoluted story, but the owner of the company partnered with someone with mafia connections to get his product onto supermarket shelves. Right, wheels were greased, leverage was attained, and he saw a spike in sales. The owner of Consumer decided to fight fire with fire, and there's Johnny Dio, and he outmobs the other guy. And suddenly, Consumer is the dominant company. And before long, Johnny Dio was in control of it through a variety of circumstantial events. And his plan was to bleed as much out of it as he could. I mean, long-term solvency was not much of an interest in any of these kind of taken over industries. So, he started to write clauses about a refusal to accept returned products into all of his contracts with various markets, at which point reports of green, sweaty meats started to appear regularly that were not returnable. And he strong-armed industry buyers into stocking his shelves, and he just started sucking as much money out of that company as he could until eventually there was nothing left.
So this phrase, green, sweaty meats, that's a reference not to the bagels, is it?
No, that was the kosher meat as a result of the mob incursion into the kosher meat industry. Dio was looking to do something similar with bagels.
Okay, so it's like if it works on meat, I can apply this anywhere.
Right. I can jump into a given industry, figure out how to extract as much money as possible, not really care about the product itself or the customers it serves. And unlike bagels, I mean, people can give or take bagels. They're edible gold, like you said. But for the kosher meat industry, people relied on that. I mean, there's a lot of kosher people in New York City who were beside themselves because they couldn't get the food they needed to abide by their religious strictures.
No, we hold it right there, because if you say they couldn't get their hands on it, they could, but at a price, at a higher price.
At a higher price for a lower quality, right. It was inextricably felt by the people the company was ostensibly serving.
So it sounds to me like the clientele, like the consuming sector of society that wants the quality meat at the reasonable price and the quality bagels at a reasonable price, they're going to side with the union?
Well, you would think that every normal person without a real dog in the fight would side with the union, at least up to a point. Unions can be unreasonable, just like management can be unreasonable at various times. But with the bagels, it was different because the union was actually standing up to the mafia incursion. Johnny Dio partnered up with a bagel baker in New York and found himself picketed. And this was the most powerful tactic that the union had. And they were used to doing it because now and again various bakeries would open up with a plan to not use union bakers because union bakers were very well compensated. And in response, the union would send out all its bakers en masse, whoever was not otherwise occupied, with loads of free product. They would picket outside the doors. They would pass out leaflets explaining, don't buy this product and here's why. And, oh, by the way, here's a bunch of free bagels to fulfill whatever order you wanted to buy and next time. And business was decimated. And the union won every single labor battle this way, up to and including these mafia shops that started to open up.
Do you know how ugly it got? Do you know if there behind the scenes were, mafia taking out people?
It did not get that ugly. There were definitely fights, both with the mafia and independent of the mafia, because like I said earlier, these guys, the first generation was all Ukrainian immigrants who had to fight for their lives back home, had to upend everything to come to this country, and now we're talking about the children they raised. And these guys were generally raised on the streets of Brooklyn in somewhat poor neighborhoods, and were very street smart and very tough, and were not about to put up with nonsense from anybody. And they were known to, get dirty and get mean and get violent. I've heard stories about non-union bakeries finding their dough spiked with so much yeast that it would rise up and fill the entire space and would take days to chip away. Delivery trucks would find their keys having gone missing or on occasion even blown up. And there was definitely physical intimidation from the bakers to various people to make sure that they got their way. These people were not angels. I don't want to paint that picture. But that is also what helped them stand up to a very serious threat that came from the mafia.
Jason Turbo is the author of How New York's Bagel Union Fought and Beat a Mafia Takeover. That's an excerpt from a conversation he had with Marcus Smith. I'm Tenery Taylor. When Constant Wonder returns from a short break, the White House is getting pets again next month. We'll look back at a history of presidential pets, from hyenas to bears to bobcats. Stay with us, Constant Wonder. We'll be right back. Thanks for joining us today for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor in for Marcus Smith.
A hyena in the White House?
Now, this is no disparagement of any president, past, present, or future. No. Under President Theodore Roosevelt, there was a real-life hyena living in the White House, eating scraps from the table and no doubt freaking out the staff. And the hyena wasn't even the most exotic pet to live at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. When President-elect Joe Biden and his wife Jill bring their two German shepherds, Champ and Major, to the White House with them, they'll be in the illustrious company of a raccoon, snakes, bears, and lions, all presidential pets. All of these animals, from George Washington's horses and hounds all the way down, are memorialized in the Presidential Pet Museum. And our guest is Andrew Hager. He's a historian in residence there. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, President Trump kind of famously has not had any pets. Has he ever commented on why he doesn't have pets?
He gave a speech in 2019 where he said that he thought it would look phony if he had a dog, that some people had urged him to get a dog for political reasons, but he thought it would look phony. And I think that's probably correct. If you try to understand President Trump's brand, it's hard to imagine him, you know, like rolling around on the South Lawn with a golden doodle or something. I mean, you know, it's all business and making deals and that kind of thing. And you know, we've also heard from his first wife, Ivana, in her memoir that he didn't really like the dog that she had when they were married, that he and her poodle didn't get along. So there's probably a history there. And I think it shows some self-awareness on the part of President Trump just to say, you know what, this isn't who I am, so I'm not going to do it just for a photo op. And that's better for the animal, too.
Yeah. Well, what does having a pet do for the image of a president? As you've studied these presidents and their pets, how has a pet, particular pet, enhanced or detracted from the image of a particular president?
Well, I think that you can look at the way Americans view their politicians. And when the politician has an animal that's up front, their image gets softened quite a bit. I mean, just in recent times, if you look at the Democratic primary campaign of earlier this year, Elizabeth Warren had her golden retriever, Bailey, with her on campaign events. And there was a selfie line that people could take selfies with Elizabeth Warren, but also selfies with Bailey. And I think that that's a counterpoint to her, you know, being very famously like a number cruncher and very focused on policy, you know, like very deep in the weeds as a policy wonk. So, you know, she needs to show that softer side, and the dog provides that. I mean, this is something that's kind of gone back all the way. The first celebrity presidential dog, I think, really would have been Laddie Boy with Warren Harding. But Laddie Boy was kind of a symbol for him. And he, when they realized how famous the dog was, they started putting the dog out front more. And it was beneficial for Harding. And Herbert Hoover did a similar thing. He was seen as maybe being a little bit stiff. So his campaign made a bunch of posters with him and his dog and started passing those around. And that helped him get elected in 1928. So it's a long tradition of pets humanizing people who otherwise might be seen as, you know, in need of some sort of image rehabilitation or at least enhancement, you know.
Now, pets have played a role in diplomacy, too, and some of the more exotic pets have been given to presidents by foreign diplomats. Will you tell us about a couple of those?
Sure. And these really exotic animals tend to be the ones that don't stay long at the White House if they make it there at all. Martin Van Buren was given tiger cubs by the King of Siam. He tried to keep them at the White House for a while, but Congress told him that he was not allowed to keep them at the White House. And in the 1830s, legislative branch had more power than the executive branch.
And why? I mean, were they just worried about his safety, or did they feel like they wanted the gift instead.
I don't know that there was congressional jealousy. I think of it more as like, if you can imagine, you're going to see the president, you're going to debate with him like why your bill needs to be signed or why his policy is wrong. And he's just sitting there like petting this tiger cub. I mean, it probably feels like you're visiting like some Bond villain or something, you know, not that that's a reference they would have understood in 1838, but you know, it's got to be a little bit intimidating to have those large cats there. So Congress wasn't really into that. And certain other presidents had been giving gifts. Harvey Firestone, the tire magnate, gave Calvin Coolidge a pygmy hippo. And Coolidge was smart enough to say, you know what? We're not keeping the pygmy hippo at the White House. Like the hippo has to go to the zoo. you know. So you have those kinds of things. And I think in the last 50 or 60 years, those sort of international exotic gifts have really dropped off. But if you want to talk about diplomatic gifts, I think we have to talk about Kennedy's dog, Pushinka, who was a gift to John F. Kennedy and specifically Jackie Kennedy from Nikita Khrushchev. Jackie and Khrushchev had been sitting together at a state dinner. He's telling her about these Russian space dogs that had just orbited the Earth and been returned, and one of them, Strelka, had puppies. And she said, oh, you have to send me one of those puppies. You know, kind of the way that you say, like, oh, you'll have to invite me to your beach house, you know. and you don't think anything more about it. But a couple weeks later, Khrushchev sends this dog with a little Russian passport to the White House. The FBI checks it out to make sure it doesn't have any, like, secret listening devices, like, planted inside of it. Mm. And it became part of the Kennedy family.
And I think there's a story about Caroline Kennedy disciplining the dog. Will you tell us that story?
Oh, God, I love that story. Yes, there was a certain point one day where Pushinka tried to bite Caroline. She snapped at Caroline, and Caroline kicked her in the butt. And, you know, obviously, don't do that. I'm not supporting kicking your animal. But, you know, she goes and she tells her dad and she says, you know, Pushinka tried to bite me, but I kicked her in the butt. And Kennedy says, well, that'll teach those damned Russians. You know, it's just this great story. But I think the deeper message of Pushinka, I mean, it goes farther because shortly after that, you have the Cuban Missile Crisis and all of Kennedy's generals are advising him, you know, we need to attack Moscow preemptively. We need to bomb Cuba. You know, this might go nuclear. And Kennedy backs down from that and makes a deal with the Russians to remove the missiles from Cuba if he removes missiles from Turkey. And I've read articles suggesting that part of the reason this happens is because of the diplomatic gifts that Kennedy and Khrushchev had exchanged. Khrushchev had given Kennedy Pushinka. Kennedy had sent Khrushchev a boat in a bottle, which isn't as cool, but you know, it's hard to want to nuke somebody who gave you a puppy, right? Like, if you could just imagine, like, this person gave me this dog, you know, who's playing with my kids, and like, how do you think of that person as some kind of ultimate evil that needs to be destroyed? It's just that sort of connection and being able to see that humanity of the other person.
And the dogs become part of the family. And so it's almost like, you know.
Yeah. And the dog, you know, not only was the dog playing with the children, but shortly after that, the dog had puppies with one of Kennedy's other dogs.
Well, there
so,
you go.
You know, it becomes Pushinka maybe saves the world and gets involved in a Cold War romance. So it's just a delightful story.
Oh, I love it. Of course, we have to talk about Teddy Roosevelt, who I refer to in the introduction. But he probably would you say he had the most pets? He definitely had almost a small zoo if you take them over the course of all of his tenure in the White House.
If you look at the entirety of Roosevelt's term and both at the White House and Sagamore Hill, which was his home away from the White House, you know, we're talking almost 40 animals. And Calvin Coolidge had a couple of dozen. He's the next most, but Teddy Roosevelt by far the most animals and some of the strangest ones. You mentioned the hyena. I love to talk about Josiah the badger, who he was given this badger by a little girl at a campaign stop. And, you know, he writes a letter home to his son saying, oh, I was just given a badger and it bit me. What a great day. You know, like it's that's just Teddy Roosevelt. You know, he's excited. He loved animals. He also considered himself sort of an amateur naturalist, so he loved studying animals. So having something like a badger there for him, it wasn't just about animal companionship, but it was also about science. And so he's trying to kind of observe the badger and sort of see, like, how does this thing live? And eventually they did decide that the badger was a little much for the White House. I mean, you're talking about really expensive furniture getting clawed up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you send the badger off to Sagamore Hill to live with your one-legged rooster and your flying squirrels and, you know, the other animals that, of course, a president would own.
Of course. So how about the bears? How long did Teddy Roosevelt's bears last in the White House?
Those did not last very long. I mean, those were there very briefly and then again transported to the zoo. But he wasn't the first president to have bears at the White House either. Thomas Jefferson had some grizzlies on the White House lawn. You know, it was sort of part of that era where we had the Louisiana Purchase and Lewis and Clark were off exploring and they're trying to figure out all the new flora and fauna in the United States that are in the new U.S. territory that had been acquired. And grizzlies were something new that people on the East Coast hadn't seen. So, you know, one was sent to Thomas Jefferson and he kept it there for a while. But as you can imagine, at a certain point, that kind of becomes untenable, grizzly on the White House lawn. So
I think pretty quickly.
Yeah, I would think so. Yes.
Now, sometimes these animals are because they're gifts from constituents, say, or just because of the names that the president have given them, they take on political connotations. I wonder if you could tell us about Benjamin Harrison's opossums.
Yes. Now, the opossums were a gift from Benjamin Harrison to his grandchildren who lived with him at the White House. But he did name them Mr. Protection and Mr. Reciprocity, which those were apparently two pillars of Republican trade policy in the 1890s. So he's kind of naming his pets based on what his policies are, which seems a little unfair to the grandkids, you know, like I don't know that your grandson really cares about reciprocity, buddy. Maybe let him name the opossum. But, you know, it makes for a good press story somewhere and allows him then to give a brief speech, you know, re-explaining what his thoughts are. And you see a little bit more of that later on. Calvin Coolidge had been given some lion cubs, which, again, went directly to the zoo. But I think he named them Tax Cut and Budget Bureau to sort of show Congress, like, look, I'm not going to go along with a high spending and large tax plan. So, somebody else had an animal named Vito at one point. I'm blanking on who that was, but you see this throughout presidential history. That actually, I think it was James Garfield had a dog named Vito. So you see this throughout history, these presidents kind of taking their pets and using them to make a mild political statement. This hasn't really happened in the last century or so, you know, since pets have come more to the forefront. I don't know what would happen now if, you know, Joe Biden got a cat and he named it something like Medicare for All or, that's not a fair representation of his healthcare policy. But
we get the idea.
Yeah, it just wouldn't really work.
Now, sometimes pets were sent not as pets, but as, you know, like a food offering. Calvin Coolidge was offered a raccoon for his Thanksgiving dinner, I guess. And what happened to that raccoon?
I don't know if this was a traditional 1920s Thanksgiving menu item. Calvin Coolidge was sent a raccoon by a supporter from Mississippi. So maybe it was more common in Mississippi. But, you know, nowadays, if you were going to send the president something to eat, it would probably be frozen and it'd be fine. It would get there in a day or two. Everything would be okay. They didn't have the refrigeration. You weren't going to send a dead raccoon from Mississippi to D.C. and have it still be good. So they send a live raccoon, and the Coolidges open this box, and they think, you know, we can't kill this creature. She looks really cute. Well, they didn't know it was a she at first, but they decided to keep the raccoon. And once they found out that the raccoon was a she was given the name Rebecca, and she was given a handmade collar that said White House raccoon, and they built a little habitat for her in a tree outside the Oval Office so that the president could see her while he was working. They eventually even brought her a male companion raccoon named Reuben, but Rebecca didn't seem to like Reuben, and once Reuben showed up, Rebecca started escaping the White House grounds more often.
She's fleeing this forced marriage, this arranged marriage.
She was
fleeing
from the forced marriage, yes. and so she ended up at the Rock Creek Zoo, which is now the National Zoo, eventually as well. But you do see a lot of constituents offering gifts still, but now it's always cats and dogs. Like, someone did try to offer President Trump a golden doodle named Patton at the beginning of his term. He didn't accept, but I don't think anyone has tried to offer him a live animal as a food source, unless you count the turkey pardonings that happen every Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Oh, well, Andrew Hager, we've had such fun talking to you. Tell me, where are you located and where can we find more if we want to explore your collection?
Well, currently we're looking for a permanent home, but all of the information I've talked about and much more is on presidentialpetmuseum.com. I would recommend your listeners go there. Like I said, we are looking for a permanent home. It's probably going to be after the pandemic, so maybe late next year. And it would probably be somewhere in the Baltimore, D.C. metro area, which is, kind of where I'm based and where the museum's director, Bill Hellman, is also based. So that's what we're looking at, but we don't have a set time frame on that right now.
Andrew Hager is the historian in residence at the Presidential Pet Museum. Thank you so much for sharing your stories with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was delightful. Anytime.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Monday on Constant Wonder, we're going to cozy up to sharks. They aren't the cuddliest creatures out there, but they serve a vital environmental role, and they need more love than they often get. And if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, and you love what you're hearing, please give us a 5-star review right there at the bottom of your episode list. It helps so much to spread the word about our show. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.